Wow, there was a lot of stuff going on in rock and roll history this week, wasn't there?
Must have been the fall or the autumn or something. Yeah, it was a packed. It was hard to choose, eh, Tony?
It was really hard. I felt like we had enough for about four episodes if we wanted. It was nuts. So much going on. So we had to leave out some really good ones. I guess we'll save those for next year, won't we?
Well, and the thing is, next year we'll be probably doing it in person again. I just loved being with you last week and doing it in person live. So, yeah.
Well, me too. But I got to say, you know, that new microphone you're using sounds really good. So
thanks to you.
No problem. But you ready for a road trip? This is a real mixed bag we've got today, so we probably should get started.
I'm always ready. Let's go.
Okay, here we go. I'll fire it up. Maps?
Check.
Snacks?
Double check.
Tunes?
Check.
I'm Tony Stewart.
I'm Aaron Badgley.
And we are cruising the rock and roll highway in our Wayback Music Machine. Are you ready, my friend?
I sure am.
I have the feeling this is going to be the start of a great adventure.
Kind of a magical mystery tour.
Somehow I knew you were going to say that. Now, for the first stop on the road trip, we have to go back to September 14th, 1955. Now, last week, you were mentioning about Dolly Parton doing the nail clicking for her typing in 9 to 5. So have you grown your nails for the push-button sound effect? Or?
Well, I grew them and then I bit them off because I had a bad meeting this week. No, just kidding. Okay, I'm ready to plug in the date. How about that?
Yeah, sure. Give us the old sound effect and I'll cue up the time machine.
Sound effect? It's a computer.
Okay.
There we go.
Winston tastes good like a cigarette should. Winston tastes good like a cigarette should. Winston gives you real flavor, full, rich tobacco flavor. Winston's easy drawing too. The filter lets the flavor through. Winston tastes good like a cigarette should.
Man, I love those old commercials, Tony. I don't know where you find them, but I love them. They're great.
Yeah, me too. That must have been a great time. You know, they weren't always into presenting facts, if you know what I mean.
Well, they're distorted facts.
Or alternative facts, maybe. Isn't that
different
what
reality facts?
Yeah, because I never knew that smoking was good for you, you know?
I keep telling you, there's that one movie, I wish I could find the title, where the doctor is talking to a woman who's like 8 months pregnant, and he's smoking and she's smoking.
Well, oh, here my. We are, and we're in New Orleans, and it's September 14th, 1955, and this is an interesting one, because Little Richard, such an important figure in early rock history, and on September 14th, he entered a New Orleans recording studio and he began 2 days of recording, but things were not going all that well. But during a break, he was with his producer, a guy named Bumps Blackwell, and they went to the Great. Dewdrop Inn for lunch. Richard went over to the piano and he started playing the piano in the bar like crazy, and he was singing a loud and, they say, lewd version of a song called Tutti Frutti. And with only 15 minutes in the session, they ran back and he recorded the song, and he coined that famous phrase, right? A wop ba ba loo bop ba wop bam boom, and history was made, as they say. But can you imagine rock history without Tutti Frutti?
Well, and he had been making records since 51, and he didn't have any hits. He was, so it doesn't surprise me that things weren't going well in the studio. He just wasn't finding his sound yet. So it took him a few years, but he found his sound all right.
Oh, did he ever? And you know, he was, I always like talking about Sister Rosetta Tharpe, right? But Sister Rosetta Tharpe was kind of the one who prompted him into becoming a singer in the first place, right? She had him open for her. I didn't realize he was this young, but she had him open for her. She'd heard him singing, and she had him open for her when he was 14 years old. Isn't that unbelievable?
Wow. Cool.
Yeah, talk about a vote of confidence, eh? But yeah, it took him a little while to find his voice, and then he just exploded. I mean, the string of hits he had in that three-year period, right, about 55 to 58. I mean, what did he have, about 15 songs, right, that hit the charts? Yeah. It was pretty nuts.
on the specialty label, which is, you know, and I mean, when you talked earlier about it, he influenced the Beatles. I mean, McCartney has often said, and Little Richard often said, that McCartney got that famous Beatle whoo from Little Richard. And McCartney never denied it. He's like, yeah.
Well, that's right. Little Richard. Because they were on tour together, right? And he used to always coach McCartney through that stuff. And I love that famous photograph of the four lads sitting with Little Richard because they look so young. That's one of my favorite photos.
That's a great. And one of your favorites played organ for him from 62 on, Billy Preston.
Oh, yeah. I didn't realize that Billy Preston had played with Little Richard, but isn't that interesting?
And that's where the Beatles met Billy Preston for the first time.
Oh, that's so cool, isn't it? What a great connection. So
I know.
You know, Little Richard's, he was kind of, you know, really the first big crossover artist, wasn't he? I mean, he started getting black kids and white kids together listening to his shows. And he's always been inextricably linked, unfortunately, with Pat Boone. And I think it's just one of those symbiotic relationships that, you know, people like Dick Clark were playing the Pat Boone sanitized versions of Little Richard tunes, but they would never have been heard if it wasn't for Pat Boone singing that stuff, right?
Yeah, and Pat Boone charted higher than Little Richard's version. I mean, you've heard Pat Boone's version of this, right?
Oh my gosh, yes. I wish I hadn't, but it's just so sanitized. It's awful.
You know, with his, and I'll have this vision in my head of him in that suit, swinging his arm, snapping his fingers, going a wah ba ba loop.
Oh yeah, it's. You know, but isn't there the famous story that he was, Little Richard, Richard Penniman, was working as a dishwasher and he heard the Pat Boone version of one of his songs on the radio and he thought, man, no way, I gotta, you know, get out there again. And it is really sad, right? You said, I'm looking at your notes and Richard peaked at 21 and Pat Boone hit number 12, which is a shame, eh?
You know, it foretold the very famous Rush album, 2112. No, just kidding. But yeah, you know, Elvis did a good version of Tutti Frutti on his first album. The Beatles recorded it, and he used to perform it live in Hamburg, Germany. I mean, it's one of those pinnacle songs, and unfortunately, you know, Pat Boone had the hit, and by the way. You're fine. You're Italian background, right?
Yes.
I did not know that Tutti Frutti was Italian for...
It's all fruits. Means all
it's
fruits.
It's all fruits. I didn't know that. That's hilarious.
Now, McCartney also was inspired to become a singer, wasn't he, after he saw... What was the movie that Little Richard was in? And McCartney saw it at the theater when he was about 15 or something? And
yeah. That's with Jane Mansfield.
Yeah.
Girl Can't Help It.
The Girl Can't Help It. But yeah, that was a big moment in Paul McCartney's upbringing as well. And, you know, the importance of Little Richard just can't be overstated. I mean, I think as important as Elvis.
But you mentioned Paul McCartney. And what's interesting is that in our list of all the stuff that happened, you mentioned the recording of the song Birthday. And when the Beatles were recording Birthday, they stopped recording at night. Because they were showing Girl Can't Help It on BBC.
Oh, wow.
So they all went back to McCartney's house, watched the movie. This is 68. They go back to McCartney's house, watch the movie. They go back and they record Birthday. So.
Oh, there you go. That's really cool. But yeah, this was the moment right here on September 14th, 1955, you know, and that changed his career forever. And he was in and out of the music business, of course, over the years. But, you know, I have to say, I'm not a big Dick Clark fan, but it was nice to see later on, I think it was, you know, 64 maybe, that Dick Clark had Little Richard on American Bandstand, and kind of, you could tell he acknowledged that he dropped the ball a bit in not having him on earlier, didn't he?
Yeah. I think, you know, Dick Clark's not my favorite. I think we've been down this road before. Good friend of Pat Boone's. You know, I agree. Did you know what I did? There's an interview with Little Richard, and you know, he said one of the most embarrassing things ever was when Disney took the song Tutti Frutti and they animated Donald Duck singing to Daisy, because in the song it says, got a girl named Daisy, right? And Little Richard said, that was the most humiliating moment of my life. I thought, Wow. Donald, I'd love to see Donald Duck sing one of my songs.
Well, yeah, I suppose, eh? But I guess it just back then, too, it would have been, well, it would have been like Elvis Presley having to sing to that dog on the Steve Allen show, right?
Right.
I think
right,
Elvis, right. That was one of his all-time career lowlights. You know, he's just mortified. And you could tell he just could not wait to get off that stage. But Richard's antics, I mean, his dress, you know, not only did he break that color barrier, but he also didn't really hide the fact about his sexuality. He didn't go out of his way to avoid it. Let's put it that way.
Well, you know, this is the thing, right? We think we're so very advanced in 2021 and 2022, 2020, but this is a guy in 1955 that was basically, like him and Elvis and Jerry Lee, these people were really pushing the line. I mean, Elvis with his form of dance, you know, Elvis the Pelvis, Jerry Lee with just waking up in the morning was enough for Jerry Lee. But, you know, there's little Richard, and he was breaking a lot of boundaries and accepted, too, by the way.
Well, that's exactly. And, yeah, a lot of white kids listening to little Richard. And he, you know, helped also segregate concert audiences, which, again, is a huge thing.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think he's up there with Elvis in terms of importance of the history of rock and roll.
Well, and that's where he gets that you know, we always call Elvis the king of rock and roll, right? But they always refer to little Richard as the architect of rock and roll. And I think he liked that title.
Yeah, well, that's a good title. It's a nice one.
Absolutely. Now, what would have been on the charts this week?
Well, the charts was a slow transition to rock and roll. So I decided to go to the singles chart this week. So the top five singles chart in America. Number five was Four Aces with Love is a Many Splendor Thing. Not really rock and roll.
No.
Number four is a song that we've talked about an awful lot, Tony. Bill Haley and his Comets with Rock Around the Clock.
Yep. We talked about that last week, actually. Yeah.
You know what's funny? I was watching TV yesterday, and an old episode of Happy Days came on, and I totally forgot that was the theme song for the first season of Happy Days.
Oh, you know, that's right. That's right.
Remember the jukebox, the record comes on?
Yeah.
Anyways, yeah. The Fontaine Sisters, Where Are They Now? Probably passed away. Number three with 17. Number two, here's a guy that I love too, and I think we've talked about him. I love Fats Domino.
Oh, me too.
New Orleans. Ain't That a Shame?
That is one of my all-time favorite songs. That is such a great track.
It's, and the way he does it, you know, the doo-doo, doo-doo. Yeah, I love... And number one is the ever-popular Mitch Miller. Sing along with Mitch, Yellow Rose of Texas.
Now, I have a connection to Mitch Miller. Can I share that?
Sure.
So, you know, I'm a, you know, clarinet player, saxophone player, etc., right? But my clarinet professor in university, early on in his career, actually toured with Mitch Miller's band, so...
Are you serious?
Yeah, yeah. So
okay, that's pretty cool.
It is very cool. So
that's pretty cool.
There's that 6 degrees of separation, right?
That's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. And just because you love the song so much, I want to tell you that the number one song on jukeboxes, because they used to actually chart jukebox plays, number one was Ain't That a Shame.
Well, I'm not surprised by that at all. Now, where are we heading next? Let's take a look here.
We're going to head out to the Joshua Tree in California.
Oh, this is a great story. Yes. Let's
do it. It's a very bizarre story.
This is weird. Well, you know what? This, you can't make this stuff up, folks. So, yeah, why don't you punch it in and we'll head there right now.
There we go.
Well, Aaron, I think this is a first, but the Wayback Music Machine has landed in the desert. What's going on?
Well, first of all, I'm really glad you topped up the water because it's mighty hot out here.
It is really hot.
So we're at, I don't even know why we're here. Well, we're here because 26-year-old Graham Parsons, who had been in the Birds from 1968 to 69, and the Flying Burrito Brothers from 69 to 70, they went solo. He passed away under mysterious circumstances in Joshua Tree, California. And his death was attributed to heart failure, but later was officially announced as a drug overdose. Tony, I really want to give you the next part of the story.
Well, because like I said in the last segment, like you cannot make this stuff up. So I don't know where to begin, Aaron. I really don't. So basically, yeah, Graham Parsons dies, and he wants his body, he wants to be buried in Joshua Tree National Park in California. His family, however, wants the body returned to them. So a couple of his friends, his manager, Phil Kaufman, and a guy named Michael Martin, who was a former roadie of the Byrds, they manage, and this is a story like only in rock and roll, they decide that they're going to impersonate funeral employees. And Martin actually had, get this, he actually had a hearse, like his family had a hearse. So that makes it even more bizarre. But they decide that they're going to be funeral employees, and they drive to the airport in Los Angeles at LAX, and they convince the guard, I guess it was, they convince the guard that they are there on the family's instructions to grab the body. And the guard releases them. And it gets stranger than that, though. There was a police officer parked there, and the police officer helped load the casket into the hearse. And they take off, and they bring this body to Joshua Tree National Park, and they are pouring gasoline on it and lighting it on fire. And it starts to rain, and and of course, people are seeing the smoke, and people are coming to check it out, and so they have to make a getaway, and so they take off. But it's, and so people see the casket there, and now it's become a little monument where Graham Parsons' casket is, and people still know where it is. But isn't that the most unusual thing? So Phil Kaufman and Michael Martin, I mean, just talk about chutzpah, right? Like,
I don't think there's another word that fits that, you know. Yeah, and actually, I'm going to Los Angeles to visit our daughter in October, and we're staying near where his... I'm a big Graham Parsons fan. So she meets like a pilgrimage. My daughter's been there several times, and she says there's tons of people always there to pay... You know, even in 2021, there's people still paying their respects to Graham Parsons, right? But I don't know, man. Dressing up like funeral parlor—it's
the most unreal story, and but it's such a rock and roll story, isn't it? And he was, now the other part was Kaufman. His house was being used to film a movie, and he goes back home, and they're all chatting about the story, and the police came there and arrested him there. But it is wild, and they got charged, but they basically didn't face a real stiff sentence or anything like that. As far as I know, they got off almost scot-free.
A stiff sentence? Like a stiff? Very good. Very good, Tony. Well, congratulations.
That was unintentional, but... but, this is one of those legendary stories, and I'm sure, judging by what I've read about Kaufman, I'm sure he embellished parts of it. I think he was a little bit liberal with facts, but it is a great story.
Well, it is a great story, and it couldn't be for anyone other than Graham Parsons, who was born, by the way, with the remarkably un-rock and roll name Ingram Cecil Conner III.
Oh my goodness!
Who described his music as cosmic American music, which I think is a really good term, isn't it?
Yeah, that would be an interesting description for sure.
So I think if anyone's going to have their coffin lit on fire by your manager and roadie, it's got to be Graham Parsons. It's not going to be Pat Boone. Just kidding. It's not going to be Pat Boone. But as I said, I'm a big fan. I mean, I love the Flying Burrito Brothers. I grew up with this because my brother, I have four brothers, everyone. And my second eldest brother, he loved the Flying Burrito Brothers. And I used to spend one weekend a month with him. And that's all I'd hear for the entire weekend was Flying Burrito Brothers. And the song that always sticks out of my head is Sin City, which I just think is a work of art.
So. Yeah, Sin City is a great song.
Isn't it a great song? I love that song. So, and let's not forget the stuff he did with Emmylou Harris, who I love, by the way.
Mm-hmm, me too.
I don't know that there would be an Eagles without a Graham Parsons, especially with the Sweetheart of the Rodeo album by the Byrds, which really was like a cross between rock and country. And I think he influenced people like the Byrds and sorry, not the birds, the eagles, who are birds, I guess, got out of that one.
There, nice,
the eagles,
nice job.
And Poco, people like that.
Well, absolutely. And he's pretty hard to pin a style down on him, for sure. Now, September 9th, what was on the charts here?
Well, I did the top five singles again because I thought it was an interesting... I love these singles charts. Number five was Grand Funk. Now, sometimes they were Grand Funk Railroad. Sometimes they were just Grand Funk. Here, they were just Grand Funk. We're an American Band.
Oh, great song.
Yeah, it's classic, right?
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever heard Nash the Slash do that?
No, I haven't.
Oh, I'll send you a link. It's quite good. Number four is Paul Simon with the Dixie Hummingbirds and Love Me Like a Rock. Loves Me Like a Rock. I guess it's an S, right? Number three, Dawn, featuring Tony Orlando. Has anybody seen My Sweet Gypsy Rose?
Well, there you go. Another Italian connection.
Hey, you know what? I listen to him every Saturday night on the radio now.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, he's on a station in New York City. It's quite good. Number two is Marvin Gaye, Let's Get It On.
That would explain why so many babies were born about 9 months later. Okay.
Well, between Marvin Gaye and Barry White, yeah. And number one, the just one of the weirdest songs, in my opinion, ever to make number one, Delta Dawn by Helen Reddy.
Yeah, I didn't realize that charted at number one. That's incredible.
I didn't either, Tony. Like, I just thought, great. I mean, it's a great song and all, but I thought, number one, really? But
yeah.
We used to sing that in choir at school.
Well, we've got one more stop to make today. We're going to go to September 18th, 1983, and we're going to be talking about a band that neither one of us are big fans of, but you can't deny that these guys certainly knew how to market themselves.
Huh. Well, speaking of which, you can actually go on their website and buy an official coffin with their, you know, which doubles as a cooler for you if you want to store your beer. But anyways, yeah.
Well, yeah, I was on their website today. It's pretty interesting, actually.
All right, I should plug in for what year? 83, right?
83, September 18th.
Here we go.
All right, here we go.
So we're in New York. It's 1983. It's September 18th to be exact. And a band is going to do something they had never done in their career. Kiss is going to appear without their makeup for the first time on MTV, promoting the album with the lovely title, Lick It Up. Yeah. I can't say that. I think every time I hear that title, I think of Spinal Tap.
Yeah, exactly.
Love Glove. And I mean, this group had been wearing makeup since 73. And do you remember, Tony, it was like everyone tried to get a photo of a member of Kiss without makeup.
Oh, yeah, it was a big deal. Like, even as kids, we were thinking about that. Like, what do they look like without their makeup? And
yeah, yeah. And, well, now we know.
Well, and you know, I was watching, as we were researching this episode, I was watching a bunch of their videos from that period where they went makeup-free, right? And it's, some of them look awkward. Like, Gene Simmons, to me, looks awkward a little bit without all the makeup on, you know, where he became that character, because he was always the most flamboyant of the four, you know, doing the spitting blood and having his tongue altered and all that stuff. And
breathing fire.
Yeah, yeah. But he looked a little awkward. It was, they're not my favorite band. I think that's no big secret. And you know, I found that period after they went without makeup. I mean, their music's very, very formula for sure. But they certainly knew how to crank out hits because they never really went away. Like, that band had longevity.
Well, I don't know if you've seen it. There's a really good documentary that just came out called Kistory. And I'm not a fan of their music. I don't own any of their records.
Yeah, me neither.
Great documentary, though. And it's funny you say that about the awkwardness, because Simmons talks about that. See, you picked up on that. And he was... You know, with the makeup on, I mean, we're talking about Gene Simmons and Paul Stanley, two Jewish kids who didn't drink, Simmons says, I've never had a drink, never did a drug. They were very clean. They were really in it for the music and models. But, they were very clean living people. And they were trying to compete with the hair bands of the 80s, you know, the Bon Jovis and the Cinderellas and the And they didn't feel comfortable because that wasn't their thing. Their thing was the makeup, the horror film, the glam rock. So you could see the uncomfortableness with Gene Simmons because he's probably thinking, I feel naked without that makeup on. You know?
Well, that's right. And he played it up in interviews because I remember the Mike Douglas interview where, you know, Mike Douglas was asking him about his character and he said, I'm evil incarnate, right? Which was just, he was just playing around. But I mean, it just added to that legend that was building around him.
One of the funniest jokes ever was on Paul Lynde had a Halloween special.
Oh, yeah.
And he had Kiss on, and he's interviewing them, and he says to Kiss, "What happened? Did you guys get into a fight?" And your mother said, "Kiss and make up." I tried to imitate Paul Lynde. I'm not doing a good job, but that was just a great line.
Yeah, absolutely. But they've managed. They were masters of promotion, though, you know, because if you actually just sit back and listen to the music, it's okay. And as a band, they're okay, in my opinion, but they're not outstanding, you know, like they're not outstanding musicians.
But they admit to it as much. They admit to that. I mean, they knew they weren't going to make it on talent. They knew they weren't going to be the next Zeppelin or the next Who or the next Beatles, although they love the Beatles.
Yeah.
They knew that they knew their limitations. And they did a concept album. And when you see the interview, it's very funny because they're going, I don't know, we tried to do a concept album. We're not the Beatles. We're not Pink Floyd. This was so bad. And they're admitting to it on TV. Like, that was this horrible album, man. Yeah, it was. But you're right. They weren't great. I mean, I like Beth and I like I Was Made for Loving You and their hits, right?
Yeah, but... how long were they makeup free? It was quite a while too, wasn't it? About 10 years.
Well, a few years. But then they went back to the makeup thing because, again, they realized that, they really needed the makeup on.
Yeah.
It was better. But we were talking before, and they've only had one album go number one, and that was only in Australia.
Yeah, I would have sworn that Kiss must have had a number one album. Isn't that interesting?
And their only number one album came in the 90s, an album called Psycho Circus. And they never had a number one single. Their highest charting single was Beth, which peaked at number 7 in 76.
Wow.
And the Forever remix in 1990. They sold 100 million records, yeah. But they just never made it to that pinnacle spot.
Well, because I remember as a kid, you know, particularly, like Kiss was everywhere, right? And all the merchandise and the comic books. And I remember reading the comic books and... You know, half the kids at school had Kiss lunchboxes, and I mean, they were the masters of promoting themselves.
Everyone, after this podcast, go on to kiss.com and just look at how they've marketed themselves.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Yeah, it is amazing, and they're still doing it. Now, 83, though, September 83, what was on the charts here?
I just want to say that my wife, Andrea, should be grateful I don't collect Kiss. I collect Beatles.
That's right. Be taking out another mortgage on the house if you did.
I'd be on the fifth mortgage. But the Beatles were never the best marketer. They're better now, but they were never great. So the 1983, the top five singles, I'm going to say for the first time, I love every single one of these.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I do. I really do. Number five is Eurythmics. Sweet Dreams Are Made of This.
Yeah, fantastic song.
Number four, okay, it's over the top. It's totally dramatic, but I love Bonnie Tyler, Total Eclipse of the Heart.
Oh, yeah, that's 80s all the way for sure.
Oh, I don't know what to do. I'm always in the dark. Number three, Montreal's own Men Without Hats and the Safety Dance. And have you heard their new version of it called No Friends of Mine?
I have not.
It's really slow and it's fantastic. It's really slow.
Oh, gosh, I'm going to have to look that up.
Yeah, it's well worth looking up. Number two is a favorite of yours and the person we're going to see next year, Billy Joel, Tell Her About It.
Yeah, what a great song. And he wrote that whole album, you know, as a tribute to that era in music. And it's fantastic.
And number one, whenever people come and look at my collection, they're always amazed to see this album in it. It's from the album Flashdance.
Yeah.
It's Maniac. I like the music from the movie. What can I say?
Now, you know, I've never seen that movie, but I know
I haven't either. I just like
I know
music.
The soundtrack well, but yeah.
Michael Cimbello, another Italian. Look at you representing Italy, man.
There you go. But that got a lot of airplay, didn't it, boy?
Oh, too much. I mean, I got to the point of overkill. I liked the song Flashdance better, but I like Michael Cimbello too.
Wow, what a great, this was a real mixed bag for a road trip.
Mixed bag. I'd like to say we're all over the road, but you know, you're right.
Yeah, touche, nice one. Well, shall we head back to the present and we'll take a look at what the Beatles were up to?
I think that's a grand idea, so let me just plug it in. Oh, look at that, I can't find my computer. Here we go.
I should find a proper computer sound effect for us, but it is kind of fun watching you tap your fingers.
You used to do the plug it in the radio, you know, but
yeah, we should go back to that as well.
I wonder if you could get a sound effect where you got the, you know when you change dials, the old days.
Oh, I'm going to look for that. You know what? That might be our punching in the date sound effect going forward. Sure.
Yeah, that might be fun.
All right. Well, let's do it. Let's go back to the present. Here we go. Well, always nice to get back to the present after we've been traveling, and I didn't really like the heat in the desert, I have to say.
So, get out of the kitchen.
Nice. So, I guess we should take a look at what the Beatles were up to, because they a whole lot went on. And
too much.
Well, let me cue up Rick's stinger here, and we'll be right back. All right. So many things that the Beatles were up to this week. You know, not only was there a lot going on in rock history, but the Beatles were very, very busy this week in history as well. But we picked a really cool one. And this actually is pre-Beatles, isn't it?
Pre and post. Yeah. This is an interesting one. This happened in September the 15th, 1994. Someone found a reel-to-reel tape of the Quarrymen playing at St. Peter's Parish Church Garden Party in Liverpool in July 57. Now, what makes that date really special, Tony, is that's the day John met Paul.
Yeah, well, isn't that?
And someone had a tape of it. And they sold it at Sotheby's for $125,000. I stopped bidding at about $124,000.
But what a find that is.
Oh my gosh. I remember they played a little bit of it on the CBC, just a wee bit to get us all. To hear a young John Lennon singing Come Go With Me is fantastic.
Oh, amazing. And I just, you know, speechless over that one. Like, that's such an incredible find. And
go ahead, sorry.
Oh, no. Who bought it? Do you know?
I don't know. But someone compared it to finding this, you know, Leonardo da Vinci's sketchbook, you know?
Yeah, amazing. So what a great find. And that was back in his Quarrymen days. And that meeting between Paul and John, and there's also the, you know, some of the photographs from that day, right? And they look so young. It's great.
I you know, there's that one photo, and they're on the back because they performed on the back of a truck at flatbed, and John's got that checkered shirt right from the 50s, you know, and you know, there's a bass with a wash tub and a washboard. I just love that photo too. I think it's an iconic photo, an iconic moment.
So there you go, folks. That was our 6 degrees of Beatlemania moment. And Aaron, really love the new mic that you're using. And
well, thanks to you.
And really great chat today. This was so much fun.
I agree. And we hopefully we'll do another one on Sunday where we do our show for Spotify, because we got to get back in the seat for that one too.
Well, absolutely. And if you haven't listened to that yet, folks, Aaron and I do a Spotify-only radio show called Before My Time, and it is a celebration of all things old school. And our premise is that we're talking about music that came from before our album-buying ages, you know? So we're talking about music from early 70s and back, and we've covered everything from jazz to blues to rock
Disney.
And roll. I mean, we've covered Disney. That's right. We just did an episode on the horn rock period. Absolutely fascinating. So look for Before My Time on Spotify. But great road trip, Aaron. I think it's time that I drop you off here, and really had a good time this week.
I did too. Thank you for the lift.
Oh, all right. And we'll talk to you soon. Music for today's episode of the Wayback Music Machine podcast was written by Rick Denis. The show notes, chart selection, and Spotify playlist were created by Aaron Badgley.
And the artwork, recording, editing, and sound production was done by Tony Stewart. If you enjoyed today's episode, please be sure to tell a friend or two. And don't forget to click follow or subscribe on your favorite podcast player to get the latest episodes automatically.
And we'd love it if you would leave us a review. You can also engage with the show by going on our website and leaving us a voicemail. We may even play your voicemail on an upcoming episode.
Thanks for taking this road trip with us, and we'll see you next time on the Wayback Music Machine Podcast.
Hey, turn the radio up. I love this song. The Wayback Music Machine Podcast is a Stewie Tunes production.